not spending a long time on the metro, and I don't like spending a long time on the metro. So I used to teach what is lengua inglesa dos, which was appallingly boring, or certainly was when I was teaching it. Much more interesting than literature courses. Anyway, the rhyme of the ancient mariner. What type of literature is this?
Narrative poetry,
good. And what genre does it belong to? There are elements of ballad. In fact, it is the only poem in lyrical ballads that could justify being called a ballad, really, in terms of it being in 4-3-4-3 meter and ballad quatrains of A, B, C, D. But what movement would you say it belongs to? Yes, I will tend to agree with that. We, of course, it tends to be considered as part of the romantic poetry because lyrical ballads is seen as the foundational work of romantic poetry, even though Blake was doing good romantic poetry 10 years before, but that's another question. In terms of theory, the preface to lyrical ballads is hugely important in romanticism. But the reality is that if this poem was not linked to lyrical ballads, I think nobody would have the slightest question of calling it Gothic poetry. It's only because it's in lyrical ballads. And it was included in the last minute to make a longer book. The amusing thing about lyrical ballads is this was a way of making money to pay for a holiday in Germany. It wasn't sort of this divine inspiration or anything. It was, let's produce a book so that we can earn some money so we can go on holiday to Germany, because Coleridge had some money inherited to go to Germany, and for the Wordsworths to be able to accompany him, they needed to generate the money. So anyway, that's it's important to be aware of that. It's very much in the tradition of Lenore, or however we pronounce that in German, Lenore, by Gottfried Berger, which Coleridge was very much aware of. And so it can be very much associated with what the Germans called Schauder novels and Schauder literature. Do you understand Schauder? To Schauder is temblar de miro miscalefrio. Literatura de escalofrío. Literatura escalofriante. Something like that. Coleridge wrote in a similar vein that The Mad Monk published in 1800. But at the same time, interestingly, he refused to publish in the same volume as Lewis. Lewis, in one sense, is a much more important person. He was a member of Parliament at 21. In a literary context, he was an untouchable, because the monk was so scandalous. So, people like Coleridge who are doing similar things in literature still do not want to be associated with Lewis, because that could be sort of literary death. Wordsworth, always keen to promote his own importance, says that he suggested to Coleridge that he should contribute to lyrical ballads with a poem about the killing of an albatross, a zombie ship's crew, and the wandering penance of a mariner. According to Wordsworth, basically the entire story was his idea. We haven't got any evidence from Coleridge recognizing that or rejecting that. But that's what Wordsworth says. It is symptomatic, I mean, given those elements, those are Gothic elements, basically. It is symptomatic that Wordsworth would never think of publishing anything Gothic himself. He had a far too high an opinion of his own literature. So it's like sort of punishment and gossip, because that won't affect my reputation. If it will affect your reputation in any sense. Having said that, we know that Coleridge was collecting ideas about sea voyages, about deep sea spirits, about angelic forces, about astronomy, about madness, and about dreams, well before this poem was published. So it would seem to me that it's perfectly possible, without Wordsworth saying a single word to Coleridge, that this same poem would have been published. I think probably what happened is you have Coleridge talking about his great interest in all of these things, and Wordsworth saying, well, why don't you publish a long narrative ballad, which would fill out the book, fill out our book of poetry about this stuff, and then in Wordsworth's recollections, it was his idea from the beginning. But anyway, I mean, there is an element of that. Certainly there are justifications from literary critics for calling this Gothic. For example, Stephen E. Jones of Loyola University in Chicago describes The Ancient Mariner as a Gothic horror ballad. And of course, it would make a perfectly decent horror film. Unfortunately, its biggest influence on cinema is the biggest influence of this poem on cinema is Pirates of the Caribbean. Pirates of the Caribbean is absolutely full. Pirates of the Caribbean, Piratas del Caribe, is absolutely full of references to this, very clear, obvious references to this poem. Sorry?
It's by
Stephen King.
It's by
saying that the thing. Yeah. All right. Yeah. No. I mean, this is an important element in English language culture in general, and you have sort of songs by Iron Maiden and things like this, and there are also. But if you look up The Round of the Ancient Mariner on YouTube, you'll get all sorts of songs by heavy metal groups and other people, and people doing ballads with harps and all that sort of thing. One of the really annoying things about poetry on YouTube for me is that people seem to think it's absolutely necessary to put music behind it. Why? Poetry is poetry. Music is something different. But that's another question.
Is that structure very similar?
Sure, but it's a different. The poem and the music are two different things. And so normally the music that is chosen is not the correct music for the poem. That's the problem. Anyway, The Round of the Ancient Mariner, we know that Coleridge was fascinated by Renaissance travel literature. Have any of you been watching Adventurum, the thing about the conquistadores on Canal Plus? You ought to. Very, very good. It's hard. It's not easy watching. I think it's very well done in the sense that you have a good balance. It's not sort of look how wonderful the Spanish were, and it's not just sort of look how terrible the Spanish were. These were extraordinary people. They did some terrible things, but they were extraordinary in the fact that they just survived in all sorts of situations. But it gives you quite a good idea just of the extremity of Renaissance travel experience. And a lot of this series is quoting from journals and stuff like that. So you get a lot of the feel for the experience in this. Obviously, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner does not have that contact with indigenous peoples that is important in a lot of these cases. But in terms of the extremity of the conditions of sailing around the world in the 16th century, that is important. It's clear that there is meant to be some idea that this is basically 16th century or whatever, from the fact that when they enter the Pacific, he says, we were the first that ever burst into the silent sea. So the idea that they were the first European mariners to be there would suggest something around the time of Magellan. You have to learn how to say Magellan properly, rather than your city pronunciation, as Magellan is. Magellan entering the Pacific in 1520. There are a number of other influences. One of them is The Hermit from 1727. The Hermit is a Crusoe-esque account of Philip Quarle. It's basically just imitating Daniel Defoe in terms of Robinson Crusoe. But the important thing is that in this novel, it's about somebody who spends 50 years in an island near to Mexico. There's a moment where the marooned mariner Quarle shoots a large seabird, a large, beautiful seabird, and instantly regrets the fact that he's done it, and he doesn't really know why he's done it, etc. So the sort of central incident in this poem would seem to come from there. Similarly, we have Captain George Shellbox's Voyage Round the World by Way of the Great South Sea of 1726. Shellbox describes how the second mate shot a black albatross while they were rounding Cape Horn. And then there is the true story of the Octavius, which was a schooner which was found in 1775 when Coleridge was a child, with all of those on board frozen to death, mostly sort of in positions of work, so sort of, you know, frozen to the ship's wheel and this type of thing. So again, that's sort of similar type of situation. However, we know that Joseph Banks, has anybody heard of Joseph Banks? Joseph Banks is quite important in the history of botany and zoology. He was the chief science officer who Captain Cook took on his first voyage. And so he identified lots of fauna and flora in the Pacific and in Australia, and probably was the person who named the kangaroo a kangaroo. You know the story, of course, about kangaroo. I can't remember the story now. Something along the lines of somebody saying, sort of, the one woman saying, "What's that animal called?" And the Aboriginal, the native Australian saying, "What are you pointing at?" or something like that. And that's kangaroo, and that became kangaroo. There's all sorts of words in English that have that sort of origin from different parts of the world, from Canada, from West Africa, etc. Anyway, we know that Joseph Banks shot several albatrosses and even published some recipes about how to cook albatross without any dire consequences. So it's not like every time you kill an albatross, terrible things happen. And of course, from that we get the great Monty Python thing with albatross, the snacks, the hostesses and the usherettes in the cinema. Selling albatross. Anyway, so there's a strong sense of global geography. There's very much the idea that with the sun rising in the east and setting in the west, that's right.
First from the left, to the right, and then right.
So there's very much the idea of going south and then coming north again, and blah, 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 blah. Although there is an avoidance of toponyms. So in one sense, this is because if you're going to places that people haven't been before, then obviously there are no toponyms. You can talk about the Great South Sea or something, but you're not going to say, "We went to Fiji." Nobody's called it Fiji before that, or New Zealand or whatever. But also that creates a universality about the tale. I am recording it. I'll put the thing on.
It's doing
its thing. Okay. Just get worried for a second. And also that, of course, that fact, that non-specificity, that's the word, helps to create, no, when it's flashing, I think that does mean it means it's recorded. It creates a dreamlike quality, and of course, a lot of this has a dreamlike quality, partly because it was partly inspired in dreams, so that makes sense. So it's also a tale of death, of nightmare, of hallucination. Another element, of course, is the whole idea of the sole survivor. And there is a very definite psychological history of the situation of the sole survivor. A relatively recent case was maybe about 10 years ago, a plane that crashed off the Horn of Africa. And there was one child, 10-year-old or something, who survived from the entire plane. And of course, I mean, it's normally in planes there are few people or none. It's quite strange with a plane that one person survived. But with ships and things, it's more common. And the psychology of that is very strange because, of course, there's the question of whether the fate of the person who survives is better than the fate of those who die instantly, except for normally that you're sort of floating around, suffering from thirst and hunger and all those types of things before you eventually get rescued, etc. And then there's obviously a need to explain why. Why did I survive? And that is, we know that as a psychological fact from people who've talked to in those types of situations. There was one fascinating case, in fact, of a Philippine cook on, I think he was on, was he on a British ship or an American ship? I can't remember. But he was on a convoy, and his ship was sunk, and he was alone on some sort of rafty type thing. He managed to get onto the thing with some provisions before the thing sank. I think he was a cook or something. And was able to do some sort of fishing and collecting rain and things like that. But he was floating around for many months. I think it was almost a year in the Second World War. And so, you know, he spotted, at one point he spotted a Japanese submarine. Unfortunately, they didn't see him and this type of thing. But when people can, with the right circumstances, survive for a hell of a time on their own at sea. But I mean, again, there's all sorts of cases in the British records, historical records of people ending up committing cannibalism and all sorts of things. So it is a very good extreme context that Coleridge has identified for this type of exploration of extreme experience. At the same time, of course, there are elements of wisdom literature. What wisdom literature have you seen? The origin of wisdom literature is sort of Old Testament situation where very, very much there is the Stoic idea of gaining knowledge through suffering. So sort of Job, people like that, are related to Job, Hob?
Job.
In English we say Job.
Job.
But in Spanish we say Hob, don't you?
Well,
in the Bible.
South American, they say Job.
They say Job. Somebody points him at somebody. You say Job.
No.
And you say Job. We said properly. We say
Job. Yeah, they're half Scottish.
Anyway, we won't. Sorry? Yes, true. Thank you. Very good. You get an extra point. You get to sign twice. But we saw the element of wisdom literature many, many moons ago looking at The Wanderer. Now, The Wanderer, of course, is Anglo-Saxon literature. Where is The Wanderer?
Where?
Well, not where does it take place. Where is the original poem? Yeah, in England, good. Probably now. Well, I don't actually. Not sure. I'm not actually sure where it is now. What is the name of the book? But that'll make life easier. The Exeter Book, right. The Exeter Book, what is fascinating is that the Exeter Book was in the Exeter Cathedral Library, practically unknown at this time, but it's, Exeter is only about 50 miles from the village where Coleridge and Wordsworth were living at the time. Southey, staying in Exeter, one of their romantic friends, not romantic friends, but one of their big R romantic friends, was staying in Exeter at the time. So it is just about possible, but very, 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 very unlikely, that Coleridge could just have had some knowledge of the Exeter Book and of The Wanderer. Do you remember The Wanderer? Remember what I told you about it?
Yeah.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
So the idea of somebody alone in the sea and all the horribly nasty conditions around them and the seabirds and all of this.
No, I was about the wonder, the wood, the wonder.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But he's alone at sea and the sea is cruel and hostile, and he compares his shipmates to the seabirds. And there are a number of sort of small elements that could possibly be connected. It's incredibly unlikely, but I think it's fascinating because it's actually the same part of the country where the two things happen. It's almost certainly a coincidence, but who knows? Anyway, in any case, the whole concept of the rudderless boat is hugely important in medieval literature. Do you understand rudderless boat? Rudder?
Rudder.
Rudder. Rudder, yes. R-U-D-D-E-R. The rudder is the board that you have in the water that helps you to direct the ship. So you have a stick on a boat, and it goes down. No, not for rowing. There's a horizontal stick.
Picture time.
Brilliant picture. This thing. That's
a rudder. Can you write it?
I can.
I didn't know.
Good. It's useful vocabulary. I'm sure you'll find lots of situations to use it. You could say that Northern Ireland is rudderless because they have no parliament at the moment. So, or Belgium often is rudderless because Belgium, does Belgium have a parliament again? For a long time they didn't. Yeah? They hope so. Otherwise, all of Catalonia will be in Belgium very soon. There's an interesting concept of bravery that you have in Spain. Bravery is saying, I want to go to prison for 10 years. It's very strange. Anyway, that's another question. The rudderless boat is a very important part of medieval symbolism. And so you have it, for example, in the Man of Law's tale, in Chaucer, and a number of times in Le Morte d'Arthur. So the idea that of a boat where, if you like, destiny is deciding where the boat goes, the people in the boat have no control. So there could be elements of that here too. And of course, there are elements of morality plays and morality literature. The whole idea of consequences for actions, etc. So, can anybody tell me the Mariner's Tale?
Sorry.
Yes.
This person who goes to the street, people go to the wedding, and they're stopped by a guy, to go in, and the other one has to stay to listen to the story. He doesn't want to, but there's something inside that makes him stay. And that's and he tells him a story about sheep. He was a sheep, and they sailed, and everything was perfect and happy. Well, not quite. It wasn't perfect and happy, but they said yes. And then they got, shot into the ice or something, and albatross came, and they fed him, and...
So, as they crossed the equator, they got engulfed by a storm which drove them all the way to Antarctica. That's a long way. And so, what happened in Antarctica?
They
did a path. Yeah.
And then the albatross came.
Uh-huh.
And because they were going to the albatross, then the ice melted. Well, they thought it was because of that, but it was a problem or whatever. And every time they caught the albatross, it came and everyone was happy with the sailors. And then this guy, for some reason, I can't never understand.
And initially, all of the sailors are against the ancient mariner, who's probably the young mariner at this stage, but are against him because he's killed a bird, and the bird was entertainment, basically, while they were, they could feed the bird, give the bird worms, biscuits, things like this. And then the wind picks up, and then everybody says, hooray! The wind has picked up and we can leave Antarctica because you killed the bird. And so they go up into the Pacific, etc. And then they get caught in one of the doldrums in a situation where there's no wind or whatever. And then it's his fault again. So it's important that process of having the killing of the albatross being interpreted as having bad consequences, then having good consequences, then having bad consequences again. The important thing is it has some sort of consequence, whatever the consequence is. And then everybody starts to suffer because there's no wind, so they're stuck without any drinking water and all this sort of thing. And they all start to die. Fortunately, they've kept the albatross for some reason, and they hang it around his neck, and then a ghost ship of some sort appears, and there's the figure of Death, who is male in English for some reason, and Life in Death, who is female, and they're playing dice to see who gets which souls. And all of the sailors go to Death, but Life in Death wins the young mariner at this time. And he is in a situation where he's not a happy camper. Everyone dies looking at him, hating him sort of thing. But he's still alive. And eventually, after about a week of this, he manages to look at the nasty animals in the sea, which are fluorescent, apparently. And he blesses them because there's some other living thing in his context. And the moment that he blesses them, part of his punishment seems to be alleviated. The albatross falls from his neck, and it begins to rain, and things like that happen. And so he gets driven back to Scotland, and he then realizes that he's condemned to tell his tale to the one out of every three people, and he knows the person he has to tell it to. So, yeah, more or less. Any details you think after Star Wars are important?
Which is driven by his own crew or something like that.
Yeah, oh yeah, sorry, that's true, yes. Yeah. The angels occupy the bodies of the dead crew members and do all of the hard work, do all of the sailing, which is what gets him home. And when he arrives home, the ship sinks, and the boy and in the boat with the pilot goes crazy and all sorts of strange things happen. But yes, I mean, there is much more detail. Those are the sort of general. Right. Blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, crucially, there is the point of killing the albatross, and there is the point of reaching utter despair, where he's unable to pray, so he is entirely without God. Being unable to pray with a dry throat and also because of the situation, he is alone in the world, as it were, until he recognizes that he's also accompanied by nature. His soul seems to be withered, and the universe seems to be empty and meaningless. Blah, 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 blah. So, when he blesses the creepy crawlies in the sea, the sea snakes, or whatever he calls them, then that is understood as recognizing that all life is sacred. And there is very much a romantic concept of the oneness of life. All life is sacred. And the problem is not necessarily that you cannot kill animals or even you cannot kill people. The problem above all here is that there's a completely wanton killing. Only some of the romantics were vegetarians as such. So I mean, there are, I think, Coleridge wasn't a vegetarian. It's not a problem about not killing animals. It's not killing animals needlessly, is the important thing. There's no real reason for killing the albatross, unless it is to impress the other members of the crew, or because he's bored, or whatever. But I mean, it's typical sort of adolescence situation of I'm bored, so I'm going to kill something, which some people never get over and become hunters. Right. So, psychologically, Coleridge is pointing out that the shooting of the albatross occurred when the mariner was young. He says he's told the story 10,000 times since the voyage. If that is not an exaggeration, if he's told the story 10,000 times, then he is now very, very old, but this happened when he was younger. And presumably, you do not go to sea when you're an ancient mariner. This is a memory from his past. This implies that part of the poem's force lies in its exploration of how the mind uses narrative to make sense of experience. So, we tend to remember things with much more rationale, with much more this happened because than is actually the case in reality. And when we're living through something, things just happen. As the Americans say, shit happens. But while afterwards, it's very, very important to create a causality to be able to explain things. And of course, that is also supposedly the big difference between literature and life. In literature, things happen because in life, things just happen. And so that need for causality is part of the narrative process and very much part of what's happening here. We know that Coleridge was very interested at this time in the origins of evil, the question of theodicy. Where does evil in the world come from? Also, he had an obsession. With his obsession with that. So, is there a need in the mind to attempt to make sense of experience that is really just arbitrary? There's the idea of the rolling of the dice. Even if you have something which is arbitrary, like the rolling of the dice, we need a supernatural cause behind that, life and death, life in death existing as a personification, death existing as a personification. That will explain what is otherwise apparently a meaningless universe. It's very, very difficult for most people to imagine a meaningless universe where things just happen. We need to give a rationale behind it. In justifying his use of the supernatural in his poem, Coleridge explained that its function was to express elements of our inward nature. So he said specifically that this was part of his attempt to describe the real human psychological process. The use of the supernatural was, for Coleridge, a technique of psychological revelation. It allowed the poets to bring into play, in his poem, the hidden forces of the mind. Remember that, again, that is very much part of the Gothic project. It is showing how the mind behaves under extreme experience. Well, rather than having this sort of lovely rational world that people like Pope are peddling, the interest in the Gothic is in a world where the mind is irrational, as it is most of the time. So,
isn't it basic tenet of Romanticism?
Yes,
the irrational versus the rational.
Exactly, yes. I mean, but to some extent, they inherit this from the Gothic. Both movements can be seen as a reaction to neoclassicism and the rationalism of neoclassicism. But the romanticism pretends, at least, I don't know whether I'm using that in the Spanish sense or the English sense, but rationalism pretends to do that at a much more elevated, highbrow level than Gothicism, which is just about entertainment in theory. So in the Ancient Mariner, the chief of these psychological revelations is guilt. This guy has survived when all of his shipmates have not survived, and so this exists in his mind, probably independent of cause. I mean, if we are analyzing this from a rational position, from people who have not been through the experience, a ship gets driven into Antarctica, it then manages to go north again and then gets stuck in an area with no wind. Most of the crew die, but one of the crew survives and manages to get home. And so there is an attempt to impose meaning on that experience. But the meaning is not necessarily there in any independent sense. The meaning is there in the fact that at least this mariner remembers his crewmates blaming him for what has happened. But, I mean, we know very well that there are areas in the... have you heard of the El Mar de Caballos? Well, the doldrums is... Well, quite a common English expression. To be in the doldrums is to be depressed. Not clinically depressed, but to be... Bajito, whatever the animal. To be in the doldrums. And the doldrums, in fact, is the part of the Atlantic, the area of the Atlantic, I think it's off northern Brazil somewhere, where there's very little wind and very little current. So there's a big danger there of a ship going in there and just sort of staying there and not being able to get out and being in the situation we observe here. And there's similar types of situations with currents and winds in the tropics, in the Pacific. You know why it's called El Mar de los Caballos? Because the Spanish typically, going to the Americas, got to that point and they had to throw all their horses into the sea, because they weren't able to feed their horses. So an awful lot of horses have drowned in that part of equatorial Atlantic, I'm sorry to say. Those of you who like horses. The mariner's experiences include transgression and apparent retribution, where there is discontinuity between them. It is important that we have this process of blame, celebration, blame. Yeah? Because that very, very much suggests to us that the two things are not really related. But of course, I mean, that type of thought process is absolutely standard culturally. If you think about the Tudor myth, for example, the idea that Henry Bolingbroke dethrones, ousts Richard II, has relatively successful reign, then there's the wonderful reign of Henry V, and then everything goes pear-shaped with Henry VI, and you have the Wars of the Roses, and things are only put right with the arrival of the Tudors. Well, there's a discontinuity there. There's an enormous discontinuity between... I mean, if it was a very simple process of cause and effect, you would have Richard II being deposed, and then something terrible happening to Henry IV. And nothing terrible happened to Henry IV, nothing terrible happened to Henry V. And it's only when, 50 years later, when Henry VI becomes an adult, that everything goes wrong. So... But that sort of mindset can be the ideological justification of an entire dynasty for 100 years. So this type of thought process is actually quite common in humans, even if it's pretty silly. The Ancient Mariner is one of several distinguished literary works on the phantasmagoria of crime and punishment. And of course, Gill is a hugely important part of that. In the poem, events which were supposed to need motive take place without motive. The mariner does not know why he shot the albatross, crucially. Yeah? It's just an act of boredom, probably. And he doesn't know why he blesses the sea creatures. He says, I bless the living creatures of the sea unaware, yeah? Inconscientemente. Just did it, just blessed them. So there is, of course, therefore, a certain amount of interest between, or the relationship between our conscious and our subconscious mind, and where actually guilt lies. That is guilt, I mean, in most legal systems, the premeditation, the fact that something you do something consciously, is an aggravante. Say aggravante. In English. A mitigating factor and an aggravating factor? No. No. Mitigating factor and a compounding? Oh, I don't know. If I remember, I'll put you on the internet. His regenerative acts bring about only a partial restoration. He remains a frightening figure, the impact of whose experiences unsettles ordinary life. The wedding guest to whom he tells his tale turns stunned from the feast, sadder but wiser. Okay, so he doesn't have he doesn't go to the wedding, even though he's the main guest, he's sadder but wiser. Now, of course, that is the whole idea behind tragedy. The whole idea of purgation, of purging yourself by watching tragedy, is that you should be sadder but wiser. I was reading yesterday a little bit about what Freud said about this. Has anybody read what Freud talking about tragedy and things? Basically, Freud, quite interestingly, associated tragedy with, he was observing an 18-month-year-old baby, and the baby would throw its toy away and say, basically, gone. And then almost immediately grab the toy back and say, here. And do the same repeatedly, gone, here. And he, basically, this is the baby's way of preparing for the absence of the mother and being able to see how to be able to control that process and control feelings of grief. And Freud associated the pleasure we get out of watching tragedy with a situation where we can, if you like, inoculate ourselves to grief by living through the process vicariously through watching tragedy. I don't know if it's correct or not, but it's quite an interesting, more interesting than a lot of things Freud says, isn't it? So we have the situation again where the pilot's boy greets him, and now doth crazy go, where the whole process of interacting with the Ancient Mariner drives this child crazy. So there's an element to which he is not seen to be completely stable, shall we say. The Ancient Mariner is a man reduced to his simple bare essence, a type of unaccommodated man, to use the vocabulary of King Lear. And that essence is simply the obsessive memory of what brought him to this extreme. Somebody has had a traumatic experience. He is reliving this, if we want to call it post-traumatic stress syndrome, whatever. Something like that is what he is actually experiencing. And he is reliving it constantly. He can't get past the process of reliving it, except possibly by talking cure. Do you understand the expression of talking cure? The whole idea of therapy through expressing yourself. There's all sorts of psychological ideas there. There's a huge amount of symbolism. Apart from being addicted to opium, Coleridge was pretty wacky in some of his belief systems. I mean, he was the son of a clergyman, like a large portion of people writing English literature. Of course, there are very few sons of clergymen in Spanish literature, because in Spain, clergymen don't have sons and don't have daughters, but not recognized as such. But in the English situation, we're talking clergymen normally are people who have a modest amount of money, but if they're living in the country, their children are often educated with the children of the elite, of the aristocrats, etc. If they're living in cities, they will tend to have, and still do have in many cases, grants and scholarships and things to go to the best schools as sort of poor students. They don't have the same level of money as other students, but they have the possibility of the best education. And so both as men and often, above all, as women, like the Brontes, for example, they're in a situation where they have an education, but only limited options about what they can do with that education. And one of those options, of course, is writing novels. So it's nothing, it doesn't have to have any sort of weird explanation. It could be completely materialist and practical, the explanation that this is an option for people who are highly educated but do not have the money to do other things. Anyway, because sort of living in this spiritual environment, for some reason, Coleridge came out of this not as an atheist, like somebody like Wordsworth at the time, or Shelley a bit later. A lot of the romantics were atheists, but a more complex idea about nature, philosophy, and ancient Egyptian gods, and all sorts of things mixed up together. For Coleridge, the natural world is very, very closely connected to the spiritual world. And so when it is the natural world which drives the boat into Antarctica, into the Antarctic Sea. But since nature is the connection with the spiritual world, by killing the albatross, the sailor is breaking that relationship with the spiritual world, and certainly setting things against it. At the same time, there are Christian elements mixed in, and there's a very close connection between the moon and the Virgin Mary, which is interesting from somebody basically from an Anglican tradition. But he associates the moon and its rule over the oceans with the Virgin Mary, although moonlight seems to be very much associated with Christ. there's a complicated cosmology that he creates. The force 9 fathoms under the sea is very similar to the Greek god Poseidon, or perhaps Hades. So we have a coexistence of Christian gods Christian gods, Christian figures like the Virgin Mary, with pagan gods, but the Christian gods are more powerful. Where have we seen that before? Beowulf, they're not really. There are no gods formally apart from the narrator's Christian god. Who is the most important writer in the world ever, 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 if you're a romantic poet? Milton. Yes. In Paradise Lost, all of the devils are Roman gods and Greek gods and Egyptian gods and Baal and all of these people, Philistine gods and you name it. They've all got the names of the different people who were venerated in the classical world. And so Milton turns them into the devils who follow Satan in Paradise Lost. God is, of course, more important, and Christ is much more omniscient and omnipotent and all those types of things than these pagan gods. But these pagan gods become devils. So there's a little bit of that type of interaction going on. The sun is equated with God in all of Coleridge's poetry, but there are two aspects to the sun, two aspects to God. The sun represents light, which is good, and the sun represents heat, which is bad. Don't know why, you could equally argue the exact opposite if you wanted, but that's how Coleridge's mind works. So this the bad, sort of punishing, Old Testament-y type aspect of God is represented by the heat in the tropics, and nobody, everyone's dying of thirst and dehydration, and these types of things. But the light of the sun can represent the positive aspects of God. All told, there are 11 references to the sun in the Ancient Mariner, most of them associated with Christian concepts of a wrathful, vengeful God, wrathful, vengeful desert God with no sense of humor. So again, taking the interpretation of Christianity, which says you have basically, well, almost the reality of Christianity, that you have an Old Testament God who is this desert figure who's all about punishment and retribution and all these types of things, and Christ, or God through Christ, or whatever, in the New Testament, is all about forgiveness, the nice guy. And really, it is practically impossible to fit those two figures together as one God. Obviously, there are serious attempts for the last 2,000 years, but they're really very, very different figures. And there's all sorts of problems theologically in actually combining the two. Notice that the bad and the troubling things happen during the day. While smooth sailing, calm weather, different types of situations where people are consoled in one way or the other tend to happen at night by the light of the moon. So the light of the moon is sort of Christ's clemency, if you like, from this perspective. Added to this, Coleridge had a pretty interesting metaphysical universe, which was derived from Emanuel Swedenborg and Jacob Boehme and the book known, well, by the supposed writer Hermes Trismegistus. So a lot of the sort of things that people like Rappel and all these types of people will read in terms of sort of magic and blah, 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 and horoscopes and stuff. So it's not it's inside that there is very much an idea of the importance of different types of cardinal directions. So the north is associated with home, family, marriage, human love, and grace. The south is associated with superstition of suspension of sentient life. There's nothing living there apart from the albatross, and suspended animation and death. The east is associated with the rising sun, light, the higher senses, reality, and the redemption through Christ. And the west is associated with the setting sun, heat, the loss of senses, unreality, and damnation. And in the middle, you have a void. We have north, south, east, earth, and a void in the middle, represented by the equatorial regions, which are regions that are unprotected by the benign influence of nature. So it's complicated stuff, but it's made more complicated by the influence of ancient Egyptian temple language. All sorts of people are translating books from different ancient languages, and people are taking more or less seriously. We saw how a possible influence on Blake was the concepts of Vishnu and different elements of Hinduism, and we will see that again with Shelley. Here we have the idea of some of the ideas coming out of ancient Egyptian cosmology, in which killing a winged creature, in our case the albatross, destroys the connection between the sun god and the serpent. The serpent in this case represents the human body. The serpent, and remember we have the idea of the water snakes, but never fish, they're water snakes, is the unregenerated flesh that becomes loathsome to the mariner, while the sun is experienced not as light, but as heat in this unregenerated state. So Coleridge may have been thinking of the occult powers of Pythagoras, which said that these powers were created out of pantomorphic light, and the Egyptian word for this pantomorphic light was serpents. They saw it's quite easy to imagine the rays of the sun as serpents. So it's all pretty weird, wacky stuff mixed together, and may or may not have be important, but there's certainly an element of sublime mystery. And we know that Coleridge was reading a lot of these things at the time. So this is not sort of new historicism floating about in the ether. We know that he was reading this stuff. And remember, of course, that we have this idea of a lot of the Greeks as very serious, rational people. If you see some of the things that Pythagoras, for example, believed, I mean, he was seriously out there. He may have been a good mathematician, but he also believed in the number magic, and it was absolutely forbidden to eat beans. Did you know that? Pythagoras's sect, but it was one of the great sins was to eat any type of legumes, any type of olivia. There was one of their members who was supposedly killed because he ate beans secretly. So Pythagoras and Plato, who also believed in some of this stuff, are not necessarily these wonderful rational figures. They have their moments of being wacky. But that's another question. It is hugely important, I think, in the whole romantic project, the concept of liminal spaces. Where have we seen liminal spaces before?
Very good. In Gray's elegy. Okay, so we have this idea of the threshold and the ground between two more distinctive states. What liminal spaces do we have here? Sorry?
Spanish
study? No, in this story.
What liminal spaces do we have? Where does it start?
Where? The threshold.
On the threshold.
On a wedding.
Into a wedding. A wedding is a liminal space. Yeah. Wedding, you single, married, two distinctive states. Wedding, liminal space. It's actually on the entrance to the wedding, which is it's the liminal space of a liminal space. This is getting exciting. Another liminal space is the equator. The equator is neither north or south. Liminal is in the middle. It's in this void where nature doesn't protect. The Antarctic is a liminal space. Why? Why is the Antarctic? Why is the Antarctic a liminal space? Water does not exist in one state. We have water as mist, as gas. We have water as water, and we have water as ice. So it's a liminal space. In many cases, you can't really see what's happening because of the mist and these walls of ice and etc. etc. So that's very much a liminal space. And in this type of liminal space, pleasure and pain tend to be inextricably linked. So liminal spaces tend to be associated with sublimity. Yeah, it's a place where things happen where you don't know whether, I mean, there's sort of volcanoes, the immensity of the universe. The feeling is not beautiful, it's not just pleasurable. It's a mixture of pleasure and pain. The idea that the universe is infinite is not just as, it's obvious. Yeah? The sensation is a mixture of pleasure and pain. The dusk is hugely important as a subliminal space, as a liminal, not subliminal. Of course, remember that the name sublime comes from the book by Longinus, which was called Athiel and Glad, to the threshold. Yeah, so it's all very much related. Subliminal. Where does your favorite film series come from? What's the name of your favorite film series? Film series.
Yeah.
Films. Yeah, no, that's a TV series. Film series.
Harry Potter.
Even more than that. I'm joking. Twilight.
Twilight.
For some reason, people watch this bloody. That is a liminal space, and all sorts of things happen in this poem with at dusk, at twilight, when the sun is setting, etc. Sees through the ghost ship, you know, the bars of the sun coming through the ghost ship, all of this type of thing. Life in death is a personification of a liminal space. Life and death, you're not living, you're not dead, you're a zombie, or something like that, that is a liminal space. Yeah? We don't mind people being dead, we mind people being living and dead at the same time. That's what's really frightening. Oops. Well, we won't start talking about zombies, otherwise I get told them. What happens at the beginning of part 5? Don't worry. He falls asleep. Sleep is a liminal space. Yeah? Sleep is a space where you're not controlled, you're not really alive, you're not really dead. It's another type of liminal space. So it is not necessary that the loudness, the coldness, or the desolateness of the icy world that makes it so terrifying. Rather, it is the fact that nothing there is easily definable. So sublimity can be found in this type of thing. Again, if we're going back to volcanoes and things, Volcanoes are, there are no volcanoes here, but the volcano is one of the great symbols of sublimity. Rock turns to gas and to liquid, molten rock. So again, there is some liminality there. So what the hell is happening? I will start off by telling you I don't know. I can give you some ideas, but I have no idea what's happening here. I think part of the problem is drugs. Children don't take drugs. This is what happens. You take drugs. You write poems like this. Coleridge seems to suggest that there are three spheres. A social sphere, a natural sphere, and a supernatural sphere. The social sphere, the wedding party, separates us from the supernatural sphere. So when we are busy doing social things, living in a city, with artificial light, artificial heating, Corte Inglés, Carrefour open 24 hours, all of this type of thing, we are separated from the natural world. The supernatural works through the natural, and we experience sublime and supernatural things through our interaction with the natural. So, if you want to have supernatural experiences, go climb mountains, go and visit volcanoes, go to Antarctica, go to natural spaces, because you're not going to have supernatural experiences in a social context like a city. Is it important that the story takes place at a wedding? It's a question, rhetorical question, so now you can say yes or no, I don't care, both answers are correct. It may be. A wedding is the happiest of celebrations, a festivity conducted around love, hope, and a sense of community. Remember that the wedding is the grand symbol of comedy because it represents continuity, the continuity of the community, and all these types of things. Is it precisely a divorce from such an easy, loving social world that the mariner will force the wedding guest to participate in? It's very, very easy to spend our lives, and easier, spending our lives worrying about our social interactions, worrying about our Twitter feed. Did you see Donald Trump's weekend? 21 Twitter, in one evening, 21 Twitter messages. You could fill the screen with the television with his Twitter messages. Incredible. The man is incredible. Anyway, we're worried about our social status. Yeah, what is your latest social status on Facebook and all this type of thing? By being so concentrated in your social world, you're not actually in connection with nature, the supernatural world, and of course the fact that you're going to die. So you're not actually socially and philosophically putting your house in order because you're worried about what your friend had for lunch. My lunch. Okay, I never understand that like that. We can approach the sublime by recognizing beauty in nature, and we can also approach the supernatural through prayer. And of course, the whole role of the hermit. A hermit is somebody who places himself outside society, in nature normally. Yeah? Hermits tend to be in natural retreats somewhere. And so they can interact with Christian gods as part of the supernatural thing. Is it important that what is the other meaning of rhyme? R-I-M-E. What's the other meaning of rime? Of R-I-M-E? Good. It's a hoarfrost. It's a type of mist that settles as crystals in certain atmospheric circumstances. So if the temperature suddenly drops dramatically from a situation where there's mist, basically the mist turns into some little crystal, like little diamonds. I think it's called diamond dust as well. But anyway, it's another liminal state. So this could be, if you like, la congelación del antiguo, del viejo marinero. Rhyme, that is the primary meaning of R-I-M-E. Because it's a poem, we've always understood it as R-H-Y-M-E, spelt in an oldie way. The oldie way. But in fact, if we put it into Google translation, it would say, however you say this.
Yeah.
What? No, 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 it's probably the yellow. It's some cristales. Yeah, it's mass. Cristales, see, it's an effect of that.
It's frosting furnace.
Well, no, but what does it say? Little machines. What does it say for R-I-M-E? Must say something. Or for hoar frost. H-O-A-R. Frost. Why do you have these machines? They don't work. Well, okay. Somebody will find it somewhere.
Yeah.
It's a slightly more specific thing than that, but more or less, yes. Okay. Is it important that hypnotism is implied? Yeah, we're talking about, mentions various times, the glint in the eye of the Ancient Mariner. The fact is that he seems to have some type of hypnotic process, that he seems to mesmerize. And of course, mesmer, the original mesmer, Mr. Mesmer, Monsieur Mesmer, was important at this time. He was actually doing his thing in terms of hypnosis at this time. And that was quite interesting for the Romantics. So is that idea of hypnosis important? Of course, if you're under hypnosis, you are in a
liminal state,
yes. Why is it one of the three? Why one of the three? One of three.
Well, I think three is somewhat a symbol of
men. It can be, yes. But it could also be a symbol of the Trinity. Of the Trinity, the Holy Trinity. Trinity.
The Trinity.
I don't know, this is a rhetorical question. I don't know what this is about. Does the albatross represent Christ, or is it just Christ-like? Does the fact that it was shot with a crossbow suggest crucifixion? There's certainly, at the time, just before it is killed, it seems to be pressed by a description of the masts. The masts seem to be very much like crosses, in terms of the iceberg, etc. Is it important that the Mariner's Act is not a crime under human law? Yeah? Certainly at this time, I don't know if you're allowed to shoot albatrosses nowadays, but in international waters, but the law is there. Is it relevant that the only women in the whole story are the bride and life and death? Or just typical misogyny amongst these people. Why do the Romantics get excited about hermits? Hermits are very, very interesting for the Romantics. Wordsworth writes about hermits, for example. A hermit is someone who lives in seclusion in a natural setting, making the natural world his shrine and living place. There's a mention of hermits in lines written 5 miles above Tintern Abbey, for example. Is this an allegory of fall, purgation, and salvation of the individual, or of humanity? Maybe. Is it a myth expressing a romantic belief in the one life, the idea that we are connected to all living things? Is the poem the basic Christian drama of sin, repentance, salvation, adapted to the romantic sense of the one life and the holiness of all living things?
Does he repent?
Yes, I think he asked for forgiveness from the hermit. So, yeah, I think so. Pretty sorry that he did it. I think he would have preferred not to have done it.
Because at the beginning,
Yeah, but if you... So again, I mean, that's an important question. Is it when you find out that you've done something which is potentially neutral, good or bad, when you find out that it's bad, is that the point when you should repent? Should you repent when you find out that it's bad? That's not directly connected to the act of doing it. But he doesn't know the consequences. When he does the act, he doesn't know whether the consequences are going to be good or bad or zero. I mean, the reality is probably there is not a connection between killing albatrosses and what happens to ships.
Mm.
Franco's grandson does it all day long when he's not running over members of the Guardia Civil. but I mean, there are large sectors of the population, many people in Spain, dedicate themselves to doing that. So saying killing animals is wrong in very, very modern culture. It's your God-given right for most of human history. You kill animals because you can. Yes, no, so there is that, there is definitely the romantic idea there. But as I say, Coleridge isn't a vegetarian. So it's not, and by the way, I'm sick of people telling me that Hitler was a vegetarian. Hitler was not a vegetarian. Hitler ate sausages. He never stopped eating sausages. Sausages are not vegetarian. So I'm sick of people saying, anyway, Hitler was a vegetarian. He was not, ever, okay? He had a diet that was largely based on beans, going back to Pythagoras, because that was recommended to him by his doctor. So apparently as a cure for his flatulence. He had a big problem with flatulence, which is very bizarre. But he was never a vegetarian, so don't believe anybody who tells you that Hitler was a vegetarian. It's not true. Anyway, is it a symbolic expression of how imagination reveals spiritual realities that cannot be grasped by understanding, by reason alone? So there's some type of hidden truth which we can get through spirituality, which is impossible to understand rationally. Is it a nightmare voyage into the irrational, something like a nightmare of inextricable and inescapable guilt and suffering? Is it a parable in which one man's exceptional crime and exceptional experience are rewarded by a greater consciousness and vision into the meaning of existence? Is it a parable about the role of a poet and the human cost of being gifted with strange powers of speech? The Ancient Mariner, ultimately, is a storyteller. The poet is a storyteller. The Ancient Mariner chooses one of the three. Metaphysically, the book, the poem, chooses who is going to read it. You, of course, are a proxy for the wedding guest. You are hearing the Ancient Mariner. Is the Ancient Mariner's situation the situation of the storyteller, poet, shop, bard, whatever you want to call that figure in society, who is continually telling English literature teacher, who is continually telling the same story again and again and again? Is the Ancient Mariner the poem in the sense that the poem, once written, once published, is condemned to tell its story an infinite number of times, 10,000 times? I don't know. Is the poem about the dread of loneliness? Was it one of the big obsessions of... Shit, is that the... No, oh, this is wrong. Time is wrong now. Sorry, it says the time on my computer. It says 10:02. It's not. We have a few more minutes. Is the poem about the dread of loneliness, which was an obsession for Coleridge at this time. Is it related to the Wandering Jew, a very important myth for the Romantics and people at this time? As we said, it was also influential on Gothic literature. The last supposed sighting of the Wandering Jew, by the way, was in 1774, when a man called Isaac Lakendim was claimed to be the Wandering Jew in Brussels. Mind Brussels. But anyway, so that is something that was sort of considered a possible reality within living memory at this time. Blah, 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 blah. I'll just summarize the last eight pages of the notes. People did happily eat albatrosses at this time. There was a tradition that they could bring bad luck, or at least storms. There was also a very strong tradition of sailors killing albatrosses to make tobacco pouches out of their feet. which is not a very nice idea, but anyway. The albatross as a white bird could be a symbol of the Holy Spirit. Big white bird. Certainly there is a tradition that albatrosses, because albatrosses can fly or at least glide for thousands of miles without touching ground, that they are sort of partway between the heavenly sphere and the earth. They're not really part of the earth. They have a special type of bone structure where they can just lock their wings into a horizontal position, just happily stay like that, just float.
And they can dive 100 meters. I have faced
an albatross.
Diving. And
wow.
After fishing at least, that's 100 meters out.
Yeah.
I saw the bird
from outside. Wow.
Quite fast.
But they don't have difficulty coming out of the sea.
No.
Because, I mean, they're big things. They take a lot to take off. We'll go to that.
Puffins.
Yeah. Puffins have certain problems. Well, penguins have a lot of problems as well. With getting out of the way of sea leopards. But anyway, that's another question. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Stasis. Big question. Stasis. Think about stasis. Read the notes. Bit about narrative technique. Not very interesting. Blah, blah, blah. The marginal glosses. Some years after writing the poem originally, Coleridge added a series of marginal glosses, like sort of footnotes, basically, to the poem. In many cases, complicating things unnecessarily. In many cases, doing so with a sense of humor. So suggesting that something is much more complex an idea than it is, quite clearly, as a joke. So don't take the marginal glosses too seriously. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. It could all be a big joke. There is a poem in the same collection, in Lyrical Ballads, about a garrulous sea captain called The Thorn. In The Thorn by Wordsworth, there's a sea captain who tells tall tales, like sea captains do, like old salts do, as it were. So it could just be a big joke. Who knows? Anyway, there you go. Enjoy that. Please read through the notes. We only have one novel this term. So a long narrative poem like this, in some sense, plays the role of a novel. I forgot to bring my copy of all of the pictures by the French guy, Doré, I think it was, Gustave Doré. But if you find a source with all of those pictures, that can actually help you to fix the story in your mind. They're quite fun pictures.